Welcome to the Back to the Garden podcast, the podcast discussing all things child development. We'll be meeting with experienced professionals and specialists, along with the leading entrepreneurs in the childcare sector. Children are the future. How do we give them the best start? I'm Sadie Pickering, and we'll be diving into ways to nurture them in their early years, from physical, cognitive, and emotional support. How can we forge a natural approach in this modern world? Join us to find out. We are stardust, we are golden, and we've got to get ourselves back to the garden. Today's guest is Anne Statham. She is a qualified teacher and consultant who has worked with children in their early years since 1995, with an MA in Early Years Studies and Practices, and also a Forest School Leader Level 3. She has a creative approach to early childhood education and currently works at Back to the Garden Childcare in Broadheath. I'd love to know what your earliest memory from childhood is.
I was sort of thinking back over my childhood, and I was trying to think of a particular pivotal moment. But when I was thinking, it's really more a collection of moments. So it's perhaps moments that have been talked about since and have been sort of handed down as like family folklore, really. Lots of them perhaps involving misbehaviour on my part, or accidents, or sort of things that evoke quite strong feelings. I was born in 1970, so I grew up in the 70s. My memories really are, I lived in a small village and I had a really close-knit group of friends. And that was my world, really. My best friend lived around the corner and her older sister was my sister's best friend. And we hung out, and we hung out outside quite often. We hung out in the woods by the river. We all used to come out in our various modes of transport. So sometimes I was on my roller skates. My friend was on her, it wasn't a chopper, it was a chipper, which was slightly less cool, I think. But we all used to roam, really. We roamed around the village and we made dens in the woods, and we all watched the same programmes on TV in the morning. So it was either Swap Shop or Tiz Was. So we had that kind of shared point of reference, I think. And we just built our own world. So I don't have such strong memories of being indoors, but a lot of it is about finding our space in the world outside.
So there was a lot of creativity and imagination and outdoor play.
There was, and it was really a world where we made our own rules, and adults weren't really involved in that world. We kind of created our own games, and our games had the rules, and we built on those over time. And I think childhood's a little bit different today. I've got a son and he's 7.
What's his name?
His name's Tom, and he's in year 3 at school, and he has really great friendships. But I think there's much more culture of sort of organised play dates, as they're called now, which is a term I'm not that fond of. But it's
why are you not that fond of it?
I think it's quite an adult term, and it's the
play date.
The adults organise it. They decide the time. They decide where. They decide who. And I think sometimes, perhaps for the child, there's a pressure to come and hang out with this other child because the parents are friends, maybe. And
so it's kind of
children don't have autonomy in that to just choose who they play with and how and where.
It's more sort of forced.
It's quite structured.
Whereas
yeah.
The child-led approach sounds more like what you had as a child, that you were free.
Yes.
You made your own decisions.
Yes. You sort of look back and think, is it just rose-tinted glasses? But I think there were more freedoms for children there. I did go out, and if it was a holiday from school, Mum would say, you know, see you for lunch, make sure you're back for lunch. And then we'd be back for lunch, and then you'd go off again, and you'd be back for tea. But in between that, your time was your own. And, mm-hmm. You know, we did take risks. There was a bit of a building site not so far away. Which today would be cordoned off. Yeah, but we, you know, we wanted to find the places that we felt were a little bit risky, and we wanted to kind of test our boundaries. But within doing that, I think we also learned to manage those risks ourselves and work out, you know, what was a hazard and what we were comfortable with and where our own boundaries were.
So that kind of healthy risk taking is really important for children.
Yes.
But I guess what's probably changed since then is that the world is kind of more scary, or we know of it to be scary, so parents maybe just have that fear.
Yeah, I think perhaps there is more traffic. That perhaps is one thing that's changed, but I think it's the culture of parenting, perhaps, that there are more stories in the media that create anxiety and they're perhaps shared more widely. And I think sometimes children are cocooned a little bit, you know, with the best intentions, but they're not able to make decisions for themselves in line with their capabilities always.
And that's where, so you work at Back to the Garden.
And Back to the Garden, yeah.
And there is that child-led approach there.
There is, and that's what interested me in Back to the Garden. I met with Stuart and Jeannie, who are the founders, and it wasn't really so much of an interview as a chat. And we spoke about our values, and I think at Back to the Garden, everything we do is based in those values, and I think that's a really strong foundation. And we spoke about what we hoped for the children and the families that would come to the nursery. At that stage, it was very much a vision, and the building was being built. But that really strong foundation, I think we still come back to in all the decisions we make. So, for example, we say, well, we want our children to be independent. We would look at the nursery and we'd say, well, what does independence look like in the cloakroom when the children are hanging up their coats? Or what does independence look like at meal times? We want the children to self-serve. We want the children to have choices over portion size. We want the children to pour their own drinks. What does independence look like in the curriculum? So we don't have a fixed curriculum. We're responsive to the children that come to us. So we learn about the children and the families, the children's interests, what's important to the family. And we construct our curriculum around the child. So in our environment, we have lots of open-ended materials. So we have lots of real objects. We have bricks. We have lots of collections of found objects. So the children can use those in whichever ways they choose. So if somebody, for example, has been to see a castle at the weekend, they can come and build a castle. They can find the bricks and they can design the castle based on their experience, rather than having a plastic castle that's got the steps in one place and the turret in another place. That might not be the castle of the child's imagination, so they can build their own castle.
I'd love to know what led you to become an early years specialist. And had you always wanted to work with children?
I think for me, I did a degree that was art-based, and it was three-dimensional design. So it involved a lot of creativity and a lot of time and space to play around with objects and materials. Then at the end of my degree, I was sort of at a pivotal point where I was thinking, what shall I do next? And it was really a chance meeting with a friend whose wife was a head teacher. And she said, oh, come into my school and just spend a little bit of time and see if you think it's something you might like to do. And so I went into the reception class and just felt at home, really. I loved being with the children. I found that every day was different. And the people that worked within the school, you know, I found they were very nurturing to me and to each other. So kind of it grew from there, really.
And that Picasso quote, every child's an artist.
Yeah.
Do you really kind of feel like that working with children?
Yes. And I think at Back to the Garden, we're quite influenced by the Reggio Emilia approach. And they talk about the 100 languages of children. So they talk about it's our job as adults to listen and to interpret the child's language, but that language might be art, or that language might be dance, or that language might just be, you know, in a younger child who it might just be gesture. So it's our job to tune into the language that each child expresses themselves individually. So art's a massive one. But also it might be that you put some music on and a particular child comes alive, and that's when they feel relaxed and at home, really. So I think in some educational settings, there's a sort of a focus on the particular language of reading, writing as the main way to express. But I think real listening is listening to all the multifaceted ways that children do express themselves. So, and it's really subtle sometimes.
So that's the art of working with children, to really listen.
I think so. Yeah, because I was thinking, you know, about sort of how do we speak to children? But I think more the question is how do we listen and how do we respond? So children have that agency to talk to us about what matters to them.
And how do you talk to children when you are engaging in a conversation with them? Are they like a little adult?
Having spent time in schools as a teacher in a school, I think you hear other teachers talking. Sometimes adults have a style of talking to children.
That's what I'm going to say.
Sometimes it can be quite authoritarian. You know, why you do this because I say so.
Talking down to them.
Like that. Or the alternative is sometimes it's almost like, hello. For me, it's a middle ground. I think it's the first thing I do when approaching a child is just be silent, because I think if a child's playing in the nursery and they're in that state of flow, they might not want me jumping in. You know, the classic thing is saying, oh, you've got a yellow bus, or how many buses have you got? You know, they might not be thinking about colour. They might not be thinking about number. They might be thinking about usually something much more creative and interesting about their journey that they've been on the bus. And so for me, it's about being silent at first and waiting for an invitation to talk. And children often give you that. They might pass you another vehicle. That might be their invitation. Come play with me. Or they might tell you what's important about that bus before I jump in and ask the question.
And with the questions then, is it so as not to break their flow, is it more of an open-ended question? I think you mentioned
that. I use that I wonder quite a lot. So rather than a direct question that requires them A, to answer, or B, to feel that they have to find the right answer, I often say, oh, I wonder where the bus might be going. So I use that sort of wondering, open-ended, and they don't have to reply because I'm just wondering. You know, and they think I'm wondering to myself. But they often, if you have that relationship with the child, and they you know, and it's a warm relationship, they'll want you to come and join their play and play alongside them. But it's a very subtle art not to take over that play, because I think as teachers we do have an agenda that we do want children to learn numbers, we do want children to widen their vocabulary, we do have a list of outcomes. The Early Years Foundation says gives us a list of outcomes that we want children to work towards, but it's sort of how we go about bringing that learning into a playful situation but still letting the child lead. So for example, if somebody is playing with the bus and we want to bring a bit of mark making or writing into that, rather than taking the child away and saying come with me as the adult to the table, now we're going to do writing, we would take the writing to the child and we would say, I wonder, perhaps we could make a timetable, or perhaps we could think about the destination that the bus is going to, and I could write that for you, and let's stick it over here, and kind of just subtly scaffold that learning.
That's a lovely way of saying it, scaffold the learning. And with your training in art and then working in the school, what happened next?
I worked in the school and then I enrolled on a postgraduate certificate of education, which is a year's training programme, and that was in Bristol at the University of the West of England. And my final placement was in an inner city nursery school in St Werburgh's in Bristol. And that nursery school had opened, I know because I checked, in 1931. So it had been a long-standing school and it was operated by Bristol City Council. But it was based on the values of, there were some pioneers in education called Margaret Macmillan and Rachel Macmillan. And they had worked in the late 1800s. And they basically worked in inner city London and they'd advocated for the health of children in the poorest areas. And they were instrumental in bringing in the Free School Meals Act, 1906. And their motto was really, you can't educate the child in isolation. You have to look at the whole child. So you have to look at the health of the child, the home life of the child, and the nutrition. So very much, again,
that's amazing.
Back to the garden ideas aren't new ideas. they're fundamental, really. For me, they're fundamental, and you can't expect academic excellence unless you, and it will come in various forms, but you have to look at the whole child. So the Macmillan sisters, I think they were quite political, and they sort of, they lobbied for reforms for, they were advocates for children, really. So they started a nursery school in London, in Deptford, and I think that model was then taken on around the country. So the school in Bristol was based on their model. So it had a large outdoor garden area. Outdoor play was valued, child-led learning. And for me, it just made so much sense.
Did you feel like you kind of found your calling?
I felt like I was being true to myself, yeah. I think, whereas I'd had other placements in schools where it was much more, this is the curriculum, this is what we'll be teaching, this is what the children need to know. Whereas the shift in thinking for me was really, well, let's go in the nursery school, was let's go on this journey together. And actually, the children will ask me questions I don't know the answer to. And nobody knows the answers to everything.
Because some of children's questions are amazing.
Yeah. And you would never plan for that, you know,
but we
never
don't
plan
know
for the, yeah. the questions that they ask. It was hailing the other day at nursery, and one of the children said, well, this is kind of snow and rain, isn't it? And I'm like, yeah, well, why does it hail? let's go and find out. You know, so it's
so
almost,
you don't pretend to know,
we
you
don't
kind of find
yeah.
out together.
And I think there isn't a finite amount of knowledge that a child will ever have that we will teach. But what you want to give the children is the idea that learning is lifelong, and that they can find, if they have a question, they have strategies to find the answer. So they might look at a book, or sometimes we use our iPads to, you know, research a particular animal that they're interested in. Or we say, well, how can we find out? I don't know the answer. You don't know the answer. We could ask to see if anybody knows the answer, but how can we find out? So it's kind of, it's setting up those skills of confidence to make mistakes and to admit you don't know the answer, but to work through that, to go into new learning.
It's almost like the hierarchy of the adult
yes.
and child is kind of leveled.
Yes. Power's really interesting, I think, in early years. I'll jump a little bit, but after I worked in the nursery school, I worked in a primary school, and then I came to Manchester, and I was lucky enough, I worked in a Sure Start Children's Centre, so that involved a lot of work with families and parents, which was sort of new to me. But at that time, I was able to study for an MA in early childhood and education, and one of the modules was all about power, and that
oh, really
changed my thinking, because I think our school systems are set up on quite a Victorian model. And the aim of that model was to create quite, the word was a docile workforce who followed instruction. And, you know, at that time, you know, they might end up with a job in a factory where the work was quite repetitive. But it sort of shifted my thinking, because we don't want children in this generation need to be creative in the widest sense. So creative, not just in an artistic sense, but creative in making links in all areas of their learning. I listened to a brilliant TED talk by Ken Robinson.
That's who I was just going to mention.
Yeah, I love him. And he's, I think
he's
it's called...
Schools Kill Creativity.
Yeah, something along those lines. I wanted to get the title right. I think it is Schools Kill
we'll
Creativity.
That in the show notes.
Yeah. He talks about creativity as having new ideas of value. And what drives creativity is curiosity. For example, he talks about collecting things, and you have a really in-depth interest in something, and you might collect a lot of shells, or you might collect... I think of my father-in-law, he has a lot of tools and making things, but he has a huge curiosity. So then that knowledge is then taken into another sphere of learning, and you can make connections across your knowledge.
Yeah, because he's saying that creativity, like you said, isn't just about painting a picture. It's kind of, it's everything, and we need to nurture that in children.
Yeah, and we don't know what knowledge our children will need in the future, because the knowledge I was taught at school when I was doing sort of my art and design, I was using a drawing board and a set square and a ruler and an ink pen. You know, that's, if I was doing design now, I would be doing it on a computer. You know, so it's like we want children to have an adaptable mindset, really, that they can take on board new knowledge because things are changing fast.
That's something I'd love to talk about, actually, the benefits of outdoor play and outdoor learning, but also the balance of allowing children some time with technology and the crossover of that.
I think that's
it's a hard one because you know, there are a lot of opinions about technology and kids, but how can we find a balance so it's not too much, so it's we're not creating like children who are addicted to it, but maybe like you mentioned before about, you know, if they want to investigate because they're curious about an animal and you go on the iPad, then you get to watch a video of that animal maybe moving rather than see like an illustrated drawing of, say, a lion that really doesn't look like a lion. It's just kind of a cartoon that doesn't have any kind of...
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think in terms of that drawing, or the lion, what does the lion mean to you? And there are multiple ways of looking at that lion. So you could look at the lion on the iPad. You could look at how other people have painted a lion, could look at how a lion moves through dance, or you could read stories about lions. But I think the starting point is looking at that child's knowledge of the lion. What do you know about lions? You know, and what do you want to find out about lions? And I think with the technology is obviously a great source of information that we use daily. And at nursery, we use that technology alongside the child. So we would never leave the child with the iPad as a means of filling time almost.
Yes, yeah. It's a tool.
It's a tool, and it's used with caution.
And consciousness.
And I have the same dilemmas with my own child, who he's going to be 8 next month. He's just started to say, oh, but Mum, everybody's got an iPad. And my husband's sort of like, you know, it's going to come. And I'm like, I just want to slow it coming, because it's a fact that most of a child's brain development takes place before the age of 5. So 90%. So all those connections in your brain, literally those foundations, we are growing their brains. So yes, it might come. But those strong foundations in those early years will always be there. So those connections will be strong, those connections of sort of one-to-one relationships, eye contact, being in a group, you know, all that important development is secure and in place before the technology sort of comes into the mix. I think it concerns me when you see babies in pushchairs, looking at an iPad. And there's multiple reasons for that, and it's not really judging, it's just thinking, is there a different way? And I think the guidance on use of screens is not, certainly no screens under a year, I believe. So it's because we can scan the brains now, and you can see which bits of the brains are firing up
and
which
the blue light affects the circadian rhythm, and you know, that's I guess quite scary with children, but it's interesting to know about how you can balance it and how you can really make it work for them. And so with outdoor play, what do you find are the benefits of outdoor play in the nursery, maybe also in your family as well? I've seen all the beautiful pictures on your Instagram. I know you get outdoors a lot.
Yes. I mean, and I was thinking, you know, where did that come from? Did that come from my childhood? And I think it did. We spent a lot of time outside as a family. And I want that for my son. I want him to feel what it's like to be outdoors and to feel the seasons, understand the seasons. And you'd be outdoors in all weather, which is what we do at nursery. It's not sort of something that we just do when the sun shines. We put our waterproofs on, we put our wellies on, we go out, we turn up our faces, and we feel the rain on our face or the hail, and we feel the wind. And there's a lot of research that says it's so good for mental health to spend that time in nature.
And their immune systems.
And their immune systems. One thing I come back to is childhood isn't a preparation for adulthood. Childhood is important in its own right. And I think there's a lot of pressure these days that children need to meet this set of standards or jump through certain hoops. Whereas I think time outside gives you time to just be, time to slow down, time to wallow really in nature, and time without pressure. And we're mammals at the end of the day. we sort of insulate ourselves with clothes, we insulate ourselves in the home. But going outdoors, I think there is a natural kind of physical connection to those elements.
And it ignites that curiosity.
It ignites that, yeah. And particularly children sort of settling into nursery, they're coming in for the first time, they're saying goodbye to their mum or dad or their carer, and we often find they settle more easily outside because they're not confined. They're not confined by the walls of the building, and they've got space to run, they've got space to climb. You know, they might play in our mud kitchen or our sandpit, and it's just a place we find they can settle more easily and take risks. I think part of being outdoors is again, taking risks. Sort of, we've got a lovely woodland area next to the nursery and we can go there and the children can climb on the trees and the branches. It's been a lot of rain lately, so we've been squelching through the mud, lifting your foot and your welly gets stuck behind. But it's that. It's those sights and those sounds. It's all the senses, really. So it's the squelch.
The squelch.
Kind of slight nervousness. Are you stuck? Is somebody going to help me?
Yeah.
So it's kind of a bit of team building, working together. I've got a camper van, and we go away at the weekends and we sort of look at everybody else in there on the campsite. And we think, well, what drives all these people to leave their homes, you know, where they've got a perfectly adequate bed and a kitchen? What drives people to come and sleep in a small box in a field? And I think it's that sort of fundamental thing of sort of leaving behind your responsibilities and just being in the moment and being in nature and simplifying things, really.
We're taking a short break from this fascinating episode to introduce today's amazing sponsor, Kit & Kin. They are trailblazers in the nappy world, and we are proud users of them in our nursery. Can you believe that the third largest contributor to landfill is disposable nappies? In the UK alone, we go through 8 million every day. With climate change clearly having an impact, Kit & Kin have given us an eco-friendly alternative to take care of our babies' bottoms and our planet at the same time. Their multi-award-winning nappies are made using plant-based, sustainable materials, as well as being unbleached and dioxin-free. They are clinically tested to ensure they're hypoallergenic and approved by dermatologists, and they come in the cutest animal designs. To make this company even more incredible, for every 10 subscriptions, they fund the purchase of 1 acre of threatened rainforest through the World Land Trust. Head over to kitandkin.com and use the discount code BABY20, specially created for our listeners, to receive 20% off their first subscription order. They have a range of wipes, skincare and baby wear too. Now back to the discussion. There's something you said before that I'd love to highlight about childhood,
yeah,
and becoming an adult.
Yes.
What was it that you said about preparation?
Yes, I think it was Tina Bruce said a long time, childhood isn't just preparation for adulthood, it's important now
in itself.
That is that idea of being in the moment. What do these children need now? If we take care of the now, that future will take care of itself. Mm-hmm. So if we give them resilience, if we give them time to wallow, if we give them self-esteem, when they come to meet those pressures later in life, they've got, Reggie say, they've got a pocket full of tools to help them to meet those challenges. So earlier isn't always better. So I think there's certainly within the parents of the children in my school and other parents that I meet, there's a lot of anxiety around achievement, academic achievement. Are they where they should be? Are they doing okay? And child development isn't linear, and there's certain stages that children will go through, but children go through those at different times at their own pace.
And that doesn't mean? If they're a bit later, it doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be underdeveloped.
No, not at all. I think a great example is writing. I think because it's very visible and it's something that you can easily measure and you can see, you know, my child can form letters. But being able to do that earlier, there is no evidence that that leads to greater achievement mm-hmm. in life. In Scandinavian schools, children don't hold a pencil till they're seven.
Yeah.
And then in all the sort of data and league tables, they sort of overtake children in the UK. So what concerns me is this sort of downward pressure.
The comparison.
We all compare.
Like, as adults, that becomes such... And it's become such a big thing with social media, and to put that on our children at such an early age, to compare who's learnt to write before someone else.
And I think because it's very tangible and very measurable and very visible, but obviously those things that you measure are not always the things that matter. And there's a lot of things you can't measure in that way that really matter. So I say, you know, on the whole, children learn to read and learn to write, but not everybody can stand on a stage and sing a song. You know, so it's which skill matters more? You know, if you go for an interview, you need to be able to have that self-esteem to talk, and that will get you the good job. So there's so many sort of, it's looking again at that whole child. But I think with the writing, the physical development of the child, I mean, it starts with the baby having lots of tummy time on the floor, sort of lifting their head, getting the muscles in their arms strong. And then when children are in our garden, they're climbing, so they start to sort of pivot from the shoulder, pivot from the elbow, pivot from the wrist. And then eventually that comes down to the fine motor skills in the fingers. But you have to have all that large movement first before you can hold a pencil and control it. So really, if we're asking a child to copy a letter with kind of letters, you know, at the age of four, we're probably setting them up to fail, because they should be doing that on a really big scale.
Yeah. Big mark making,
whole body movements, building up the big muscles before you move down to the small muscles. And with reading, the mechanics of reading, because we know our children well, we have some children who are interested in sounds. So we do phonics, in the sense that we start by listening to sounds in the environment. So we go out, we listen carefully, you know, what can we hear when we're going into the woodland? You know, we stop and we pause. We might hear some birds, or we might hear some cars, or we might hear just some rustling of some leaves. So it's sort of the first steps in your phonics is being able to tune into sounds and listen. And then you can sort of begin to break the flow of words into sounds, and then know that those sounds are represented by letters. But there's so much sort of foundational work first that the children need to understand to make sense. To make sense of that fundamental thing that these marks represent sounds. And children can learn those mechanics of reading, but what we really want is them to be motivated readers who read for their whole lives, not just read because they're asked to or read for a purpose. And I think sometimes the pressure of reading as a thing kind of takes away the enjoyment.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Rosen, who's a children's author, he talks a lot about picture books, and he has sort of writes a lot about the power of the picture book, which is declining at the moment in terms of sales. He talks about through a picture book, children enter sort of magical worlds, and they learn about goodies and baddies, and they learn about plot lines, and they see situations in the picture books that mirror their own lives. And actually, when the parents are reading, they might see situations that mirror their parenting. So everybody's sort of reflecting on their life and what's happening in this life. So that whole idea of sort of storytelling and immersing yourself in a story and getting enjoyment and pleasure needs to run alongside the mm-hmm. mechanical reading, the teaching of deciphering the print.
That's something that we wish to carry as well into adult life, like that love of reading.
Yes.
Where there's so many distractions, and it's such a special thing, and it's so lovely to start that in those early years.
Yes.
For it to have all these wonderful feelings around it, being read to or learning to read. And I'd love to go into kind of children's mental health. And I know you have the Colour Monster book at the nursery.
Yes.
And I was just wondering if you could kind of talk about how you, because it was Children's Mental Health Week recently, and I know the Duchess of Cambridge is doing a lot around the early years and mental health, and that kind of, it's so important how we work with children to kind of lay those foundations for life, to see if we can help support them with the world as it is, where people can struggle. So how do we support children with mental issues and their emotions, and kind of encourage them to own their emotions?
I think as adults, we can't pour from an empty cup. So I always say, sort of, for the practitioners in the nursery, we need to look after ourselves first and support each other as a team. And we all have bits and pieces of our lives that are outside of the nursery. And there's a saying that we sort of come to nursery with some of those pieces attached to us still. So it's sort of knowing, working as a team together as adults within the nursery, and articulating our feelings and being honest about any worries we have or anything that we're finding difficult, and working through those together. And I think children learn from the way we model that behaviour. So we model being respectful to each other as adults, but also obviously being respectful to the children, you know, and how we deal with difficult situations. I think their children are very alert to the emotional atmosphere of a space. So our job is to make them feel safe and to be constant for them. So we have a key person system in the nursery. So every child has a key person. So when the child settles, that key person will meet with the family, build a relationship with parents, carers, and build a relationship with the child, and be a constant in the nursery world that the parents can come and talk to if they're worried, and basically know that child best. And the key person would take photographs of the child at play, and we share those with our online journal so parents can see at home what's happening. So it's a constant cycle of communication. We're showing what's happening in nursery, parents are telling us about home life. So I think those relationships around the child are very important for the child's mental health, because we want the child to develop and sustain those satisfying relationships in their life. So it's modelling that. One thing I read recently about mental health is that children need to be able to use and enjoy solitude. I thought, well, that's interesting. Which kind of links back to the screen time, I think. And I know I've done it as a parent. Sometimes, you know, emotions are raging. So it's a way to switch them off sometimes, to just give the child TV or to give the child an iPad. So you're shutting down that potential time to kind of explore what's going on a deeper level. And on a journey, you know, if the child's in the back of the car, if they're just watching an iPad, I find when I'm sitting in the car, that's sometimes a good time to have a conversation, because it's not that Tom's trapped and has to talk to me, but there isn't eye contact. So we're sort of, it makes it feel a bit more relaxed sometimes. And that's when he sort of tells me his worries. But using and enjoying solitude, that really made me think, because I think it's that, again, that permission to yourself that rest is okay, and that in order to learn at the highest level, you have to stop, and it's almost file that all the information that you've learned and reflect on it. So I think for children in our nursery, the day is a long day for some children. We start at 7:30 and we finish at 6:30. That's a long time. And as adults, you know, we get the chance to come out of that at lunchtime and have a time away in a different space. And we want that for our children as well, which is, you know, why we use the outdoor space. And also in our garden, for example, we've looked at spaces between spaces, we've called them. So behind, we've got a lovely teepee, but behind the teepee, there's an area that's a little bit hidden. And we've noticed that children like to go there because they feel that that's their secret space. And I think for some children to just go and be somewhere alone and quiet and just to sit for a bit, that's important in a busy day. Also with some of our planting, we've got a sort of curved wicker screen. We're just sort of thinking of these little spaces within the big space where children can be quiet.
And they can just have time to themselves.
Yeah. And the preschool room have a calm space, and the children know that one person goes in at a time. And it's that idea of regulating yourself. And we don't really use time out, but what we want is children to take that responsibility themselves and say, oh, I'm feeling a bit overwhelmed, but I know that there's somewhere I can go to be quiet. So
that's so lovely.
And you know, it's the learning thing for me, really. It's that idea that the world is so busy, isn't it? And that's that idea of almost just stopping and saying that rest is important. And boredom's okay. So I think, going back to play being structured, with my son, there's indoor play spaces. You can take them to this club or that club, or should they be swimming? Should they be doing karate? Should they be doing football? All very kind of adult structured activities. But what I've learned recently is Tom will say to me, I'm bored. And I used to see it my job to fill that space and say, oh, maybe we should get out the clay, or maybe we should. Whereas now I say, oh, you'll think of something. And I just pause and he goes, oh, but I'm really bored. I go, but your brain's really clever. You'll think of something, won't you? And I sort of bat it back to him. And then what I find is he doesn't look to me to fill that space, but he will go off and immerse himself in something. And I don't have to entertain him all of the time. And
that's
a big learning for me, because I think being a teacher, I thought I have to teach him all the time. But
and for
it
him,
gives
is
me
it?
A bit of space. It gives him a bit of space. And he gets into that flow of doing something of his choosing, rather than looking to me to fix that.
So it's like a deflection almost, that it goes to you, whereas when he goes within and comes up with him himself. So being bored is quite a good thing sometimes.
Boredom is a good thing. And I think we're a bit afraid of boredom. What is boredom? I think we're a bit afraid of our children being bored and not using every opportunity to learn. But boredom is, I think, put it beautifully, where you go inside.
The space between within.
Yeah. And I don't think there's a lot of opportunity for that always.
Mm-hmm. Who is your inspiration? That's something I'd like to know. And I'm sure
I think I've been inspired by lots of different people along the way. At different points in my life, different inspiration. When I was the teacher in the Shore Start Centre, I had a lovely head of centre, Kath Larkin, and she was just an amazing force of energy, but she was always learning. And she was the person that said to me, at that time, there was the funding available for me to do some more studying and to do the MA. And she said, why don't we do it? And I was like, no, that's not for me. I couldn't. She said, yes, you can. You could do it. We could do it. Let's do it. She said, this is an opportunity. I was like, okay. But that, for me, was quite pivotal, going back to learning after sort of formal learning after a break of quite a long time, 15 years or so, and feeling how it felt to be that learner and to do assignments and go back to college. And you know, there was a point where Kath said, can't do this anymore. She threw all her files in the wheelie bin, and it was her son that said to her, you can, Mum, what would you say to me? And he got out all of her files. He said, you carry on. And there was a time I was like, oh, I can't do it. I can't, you know. And it's that sort of resilience of sort of understanding that learning is hard. You know, we say we want our children to be happy, and that's what we do, but learning isn't always happy. Learning is sometimes difficult, frustrating, tiring, but it's that perseverance to kind of work through that. So what we want for our children, we have to embody, and that's obviously not easy all of the time. But I think with the staff team we have at Back to the Garden, they are amazing. And they have come, I think lots of people come for very specific reasons, and it comes back to those values. We had a meeting recently where we talked about what were our expectations when we came here, and how have those expectations been met, or are there parts of those expectations that we still need to work on. And there was a lot of people saying we didn't want it to be like other nurseries. And so we had to sort of unpick, well, what are other nurseries like? Yeah. And what's motivated this change? And I think what sort of comes out is people bring themselves to the job. And if you have that within your team, you know, we have Emily, who's a dancer. We have Hannah, who's worked in schools in New Zealand. I feel like I need to say everybody's name now because everybody brings something. You know, Jenny, our cook. I think everybody brings themselves to the job, and then you feel you're being honest. And there's a passion there to pass on your skills and whatever it is that's important to you that you want to share.
And so all the individuals working at the nursery are all unique and all bring their own thing. And
yes.
Then the children come in,
yeah.
They're all unique,
yes.
In themselves. And it's a constant, like, being inspired by each other.
Yes.
And
yeah.
That's why it isn't like any other nursery, I guess, because it's...
That's
You've
how
got
I,
all
that's,
the components that go together.
That's
to
how
make
I
it.
Feel. And I think because we've been able to build that from scratch, really, we've had those conversations as we grow. But again, coming back to values, well, what do we want that to look like here? So, you know, we want children to have well-being. You know, what does that look like at different parts of the day? And what does that look like for our staff team? It's fundamentals, really.
So that's something, that balance of work and life.
Yeah.
For you, how do you create that balance? Home life, working at the nursery, working with children, having a child.
I think I've got a lot better. I think it's the thing with working with children. Well, I guess it's the same in lots of jobs, but there isn't really an end point. You come home and you think about those children, and you think about particular children who might be finding certain things difficult, and you think about how you can go back the next day and change something or support that child. And sometimes it might just be a very little thing that you sort of have a light bulb moment and you think, oh, that might help. So you're carrying all these kind of thoughts about lots of children in your mind, and then so for me, I do meditate. I do, because I have trouble calming the thoughts in my mind. So I'm all thinking about the future or thinking about the past. So it's just that time to stop and to let go of all of that for a while. And I think that really helps me. But also going in the camper van, I think it's kind of just leaving. The camper van's a really small world where it's usually my husband, Andy, and Tom, and me, and we don't do a lot. But perhaps that's our kind of solitude, and that's our space, and we're together, and we just hang out, really. But it's our kind of time to chat over what's going on in the rest of the life. And I like to run. I love to run up hills. Well, that's not true. I walk up hills and then I run downhill. And I just find that feeling of running down a hill where your legs are going a bit faster than your body, and I find that's the time when I'm in that state of flow.
That's interesting. That reminds me of being a child, that running, free fall, running down a hill.
So I suppose it's being playful yourself, isn't it? You're not doing it for money or any sort of reason other than to just do it, because it feels
joy.
Good.
The pure joy of it.
Yeah.
If money, time and logistics were no object, what would you want to create for children?
It would depend on the children that I was with, but I think I'd plan with those children and create the world that they wanted. So I imagine that to be sort of outdoor, lots of loose parts, things that can be moved around. So a space that could be reinvented time and time again.
Wow. That sounds amazing. What rights should children innately have?
We've got some lovely books in nursery that explain to children the UNICEF rights of the child, which I think growing up, we're very lucky that we in this country can take some of those rights for granted, but it's kind of exploring what they mean in a language that children can understand. One of them we've touched on is the right to for children to have leisure time and play time, but also the rights for children to be involved in decisions that affect them, so to have their say.
What's your favourite book on child development?
It's Simplicity Parenting. Can't remember the author's name, but it's great.
We can reference that in the show notes. We'll find the author.
Yeah, yeah. It talks about less being more in terms of toys and time, allowing time and space.
What's the feeling you have when working with children?
I think I have the whole range of feelings, if I'm honest. You have days where you think, wow, you know, everything's been brilliant. Then you have days where you worry about a particular child. So you feel the whole range of emotions. But I think at the end of the day, now I'm getting on a bit. I've met some children that I taught when they were 3 who are now sort of 20. And if they say to me, hey, I remember you, you know, you did a good job. That's the best reference, really.
What's the most important skill in early years education?
Listening and slowing down and tuning into the child. So listening in all the different ways that we can listen.
What's your favourite quote on child development?
Probably there's no such thing as there's no such thing as bad weather, just inappropriate clothing.
And what would be your advice to someone who was wanting to get involved in early years education, who is maybe just thinking about it, just starting out? What would be your advice to them?
I think to spend time in childcare settings or in schools, perhaps volunteering, and to spend time in that world, really, and decide if it's something that you think is for you and you enjoy. It can be a brilliant career. And it's really, I think, because we've all experienced education ourselves as children, and maybe some people have had different experiences to others, good or bad. We all have a view about what it's like. But I think when you put yourself in that world, and every world is different. When I work with some students who are teacher training, and I always say to them, you know, if you go to a school for a job, make sure you feel it's right for you. And again, keep coming back to those values, really.
Yeah. And on the flip side, what would be your advice to a parent looking for a nursery?
Because we're growing nursery, we show around a lot of parents at Back to the Garden. And I always say, trust your instincts. That's the main thing. You know your child, you know the sort of space that would suit your child, you know the sorts of things that are important to you and your values. So don't be afraid to ask questions. No question is too silly. Again, spend time in that space. If you look at lots of different nurseries, and I think from that, trust your instincts. And I always sort of ask about, when I was looking for Tom, I was asking, you know, have the staff been here a long time? Is the team stable? Because high turnover of staff, I think, tells you something that people aren't happy. Spend time in that space and get to know the people who work there, and trust your instincts.
That's great advice. Thank you so much, Anne. It's been so interesting and fascinating and such a joy to chat with you.
Thank you for listening to me.
So I hope the listeners have found it as interesting as I have. And for all the information on everything that we've talked about, they'll be available in the show notes. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and leave us a review in iTunes or on your podcast app. Follow Back to the Garden Childcare on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter. We would love to hear your thoughts on today's subject. And for everything mentioned in today's episode, you can head to the show notes at backtothegardenchildcare.com/podcast. And if there's someone you know who would love to hear this episode, share it with them today. Send them a link, screenshot the app, or just chat about it. This podcast is recorded at LBS Studios and produced by Simon Galloway. Until next time, in the words of Joni Mitchell, we are stardust, we are golden, and we've got to get ourselves back to the garden.